This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Brandi Clay Brimmer about her new book, Claiming Union Widowhood, Race, Respectability, and Poverty in the Post-Emancipation South. Dr. Brandi Clay Brimmer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, Dr. Brimmer, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. And I always like to start there. My grandmother recently transitioned, but she was 90 years old, about 90 years old when she transitioned. And she was actually born in Los Angeles. And so I said that to say I have a long history in Los Angeles. I'm the product of public schools, public education, tons of internships and volunteer work in the area. But one that was particularly stood out or was impactful for me was an internship that I had at the Museum of African American Arts. It's a community museum housed within the Crenshaw Mall, and it's still in existence. From there, I went to Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I was exposed to perspectives and approaches to the world, but particularly new insights, feminist approaches to sociology, history, and culture, rich, deep, humanistic education. After I finished college, I returned to Los Angeles with hopes of going to and dreams of attending law school. And re-immersing myself, quite frankly, in the community institutions that provided the platform for me to go on to Spelman, family and community as well. I did a six-week sort of immersive experience in South Africa through Operation Crossroads. And that continued to open me to and gaining my confidence to think about Black studies and immersing myself in Black studies as a career trajectory, though still thinking about the law. And I went on to UCLA. I applied and was really thrilled when I was accepted into the Black Studies MA program. That exposed me to not only Black studies as an intellectual discipline, further enriching my experience at Spelman, but also enabling me to sort of tiptoe into the history department and work with rising scholars that were coming out of the PhD program, but also to work with scholars like Brenda Stevenson, Robert Hill, and many others. And that led to a PhD in U.S. history, and it continuing to sort of expand my work in the field, but always having attachments to thinking about slavery and emancipation that always fascinated me. And you know, from there, I don't have a traditional experience in graduate school. So I've already mentioned that I took time off between undergrad and graduate school. I took some time off in the middle of graduate school and did some work at a foundation in New York, returned to do the research that really is the basis for what we'll talk about today, Clinton Union Widowhood. But at the time, it was my dissertation, and I was making my way through the archives in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., spending a lot of time there. And from there, I did I was very fortunate. I had a number of different fellowship opportunities away from Los Angeles and also work opportunities. So I was coming kind of in and out of the profession. I had time to work at a large private R1 research institution in the South, but then transitioned and had a really sort of pivotal experience working at the Freedmen and Southern Society Papers housed at the University of Maryland College Park. And so I'm painting this picture because these are all steps that really sort of led to, that laid the groundwork for the book that I would eventually write. I would have written a much different book had I not had that time at the Freedmen and Southern Society Project under the tutelage of Leslie Rowland and Steve Miller. Those are the principal editors at the time, though I had the opportunity to interact with and meet with Ira Berlin. From there, I would go on to work at Morgan State in the history department at Morgan State. And I always say and credit Morgan State with really making me as a historian and a teacher, because that's when I really sort of blossomed into both of those things. And mainly because I just had fantastic students who really pushed me on a number of questions when I was teaching the U.S. survey, but also helping me to think about my audience more as I wrote and being committed to the kind of project that I wanted to write. And after Morgan, I did a brief stint at Spelman. Of course, the coronavirus COVID-19 unfolded, had another fantastic fellowship opportunity, and I'm now here at UNC Chapel Hill. So all of those things I will pull together in our discussion today and why they matter. And how I wrote and approached Claiming Union Widowhood.
Wonderful. Well, let's get into it. So Claiming Union Widowhood, how did you come to this project?
Yes, I mean, so it's interesting. And a number of different ways or threads led me to this project, probably from the most academic perspective. You know, I was looking for a dissertation project. I had, again, deep interest in slavery and emancipation. And I was interested it was a particular moment where these fantastic books were coming out or had been out, or it was my, you know, first encounter with them. But I was reading, you know, Glenda Gilmore's Gender and Jim Crow, and I was fascinated with that. And I was really fascinated with the discussion that that book generated in terms of class, in terms of not only middle-class Black women, but poor and working-class Black women. On the other end of that conversation was Tara Hunter's To Joy My Freedom, which completely blew my mind, continues to blow my mind when I think about what it took to achieve that book, not only in terms of the beautiful narrative, but the archival approach. And both Hunter, but also Gilmore, right, talking about how they were encountering the archives and thinking about how middle-class Black women challenge white supremacy and how working poor Black women challenge white supremacy and free labor society. So these were just very interesting questions. In the middle of that, I had the good fortune of working with Laura Edwards, who was at UCLA before she moved on to Duke. And, you know, her fantastic study on legal culture in the Reconstruction era. And a lot of the work that I was doing is still sort of looking into the 20th century, thinking about poor women and thinking about how poor and working class women engage legal institutions and governmental institutions and challenge white supremacy, as Gilmore and Tara Hunter would talk about. And really from the guidance, not only from the secondary literature that I was reading, but also guidance from Laura Edwards and a number of scholars who were using pension records at the time, she said, well, you know, this might be an interesting place for you to start the study. So I had familiarity with the Freedmen's Bureau. That certainly was on my watch, but the pension bureaucracy offered something different in terms of the way in which the system was set up and the sort of deep reach into the sort of personal lives of individual claimants who were forging claims. And I thought this would be an interesting place to sort of ask these questions. How did poor women challenge or engage legal and governmental institutions? And as a result of that, here's Columbian Union Widow. it is my answer to that. It's a very long and complicated answer to what is a very straightforward question.
Yeah. And so your study uses New Bern, North Carolina, as its setting. So why did you choose this town, and what was New Bern's Black community like?
So, you know, it's interesting to answer this question now is definitely a methodological question that I've had to contend with for a long time, which is why I started by introducing myself from Los Angeles, because I had to really think about that. And I think at the time when I was initially conceiving the project, I had some hunches, right? The secondary literature gave me some hunches. Gilmore, tons of people who had written about Eastern North Carolina, knowing that the Union Army had established itself in the eastern part of the state relatively early in the Civil War, that freedom seekers were moving to those eastern counties, I thought that it would, I would be able to sort of pan out, you know, if I traced the military regiments, Black regiments recruited in those areas, that it might also tell me something about the families, and a la Norley Frankel. And so I set out to look at the regiments that were raised in the 35th, 36th, and 37th regiments of the United States Colored Troops. I went back and looked at the 14th U.S. Heavy Artillery and other groups. And so a number of things came from that. One thing that came from that is that, you know, to answer that question today is to say that I didn't really sort of choose New Bern, the Freedom Seekers did, and I really was tracing the records. I really thought that this study was going to pan out in a place like Wilmington, North Carolina, because I knew much about the Wilmington massacres, and I thought, aha, this would be the answer to that. There are interesting things that are happening in Wilmington, and there's some reasons why some things are not happening in Wilmington. But in New Bern, you have several things coming together. One, you have this really rich pre-war Black community of artisans and free Blacks and enslaved Blacks that are living, you know, really what people would say is this sort of living, enslaved people living within communities of free Blacks attached to and family, you know, attached through family and other ways. And so it's a really sort of interesting community that is also attached to the waterways. And so when you talk about movement, what enslavement looks like in a port city, I was really sort of fascinated with that. What happens during the Civil War is you have white military administrators, also white regiments, Black regiments being recruited, and thousands of freedom seekers coming into that area. So a pre-war population that's coming in slightly under 6,000, we have unofficial counts by the end of the Civil War, but there's some 20,000 Black refugees that are in that area. So when you think about that demographic number, now you're talking about a city of Black refugees that, an urban space of Black refugees that's on par with larger urban centers. And so it became really clear to me that freedom seekers were making this a really important place or staging ground for Black working class politics. And so I really sort of followed the study from there. So again, very different answer from, well, I was looking at the 35th, 36th, and 37th Regiment. They recruited near New Bern, to freedom seekers really picking that location and bearing the study out from there.
And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the pension application process was like for Black Union widows.
Yeah, I mean, I love this question because I think it's also at the heart of this book, right? And so in addition to, you know, so moving from a broad question of how did poor and working class Black women engage legal institutions and governmental institutions, I really wanted to know, how not only did they petition the U.S. pension bureaucracy, but how did they sustain that relationship? Because what I came to understand is that these were long-term battles, but a long-term relationship. And so now that I'm centered in New Bern, I started to sort of reconstruct, to the extent that I could, these stories. I was seeking connections, but always in the backdrop of those stories that I was reconstructing, how did they do this? And I wanted to write a story from their perspective, because there have been fantastic works written by, you know, Elizabeth Rigason, Donald Schaefer, you know, and others who had really talked about not only pension eligibility, but also the claims process, application process from the perspective of the federal government. This is really a story about the claims application process from the poor women's perspective, how they encountered the state, how they began to do that. And what I found out is they did that through community institutions, through relationships and networks, social relationships that they built during that critical phase of the early years of the Civil War, when they're coming into New Bern. Many of the institutions that may appear invisible in the records become very visible through pension records. And so over time, it wasn't a coincidence that a lot of the women that I was talking about still resided in James City, which was the former Trent River settlement. Others moved to an area of New Bern called the Fifth Ward. And I was able, and through sort of building up individual stories, I started seeing that these weren't individual stories at all, that this was actually a community story. And that the individuals that would come to represent their claims were doing so at the behest of the women who were oftentimes they were in conversation with through their community institutions. And so my answer to this question, which I think is a terrific one, is that this is really, you know, women sustained claim, you know, forged claims on the federal government through their relationships and community institutions help facilitate that process over a long span of time. So. Wonderful.
I wonder if you could highlight just a few of those community institutions that you talk about within the book.
Yeah, so one of the major sort of institutions that I would say would be sort of the households and neighborhoods. So it was really important for me not only to identify individual names, but to really understand where people were living. In other words, it's not that these names aren't available on the federal census, but there's nothing to indicate that these are pension seekers or applicants. So it was really important for me to have, you know, to be able to go into the Civil War Index, to be able to identify people and then retrace their steps in New Bern. And so what I began to see is that clusters of people within neighborhoods, oftentimes with relationships with other people in James City, there was oftentimes connection. Then as I continued to move forward, I noted churches, for example. So the St. John Baptist Missionary Church in New Bern, and, you know, at the center of the Fifth Ward, this was a place that I found. I was, you know, I've been able to identify quite a few, not only war widows, but also Black veterans who attended that institution. I've been able to reconstruct, I'm still in the process of that, what was called known as the Beecher Regiment 22, which is a GRA branch, Grand Army Republic branch of Black veterans who very importantly came together and supported one another during the pension application process, right, as that's unfolding for them as well. So in addition to churches, schools, neighborhoods, I would say those are the sort of principal sites where you see individuals sort of coming together. And then that really sort of spiraling out because of the nature of the application process, spiraling out to the very places where people were enslaved and bringing in those communities as well. So painting a very sort of elaborate portrait of life for the Black poor in this area during the late 19th century.
Wonderful. And so I wonder if you could talk about some of the obstacles that Black Union widows encountered in dealing with the U.S. Pensions Bureau.
Yeah, so one of the first, one of the major issues, right, when you're talking about this question is, you know, I think that historians quite rightfully, and myself as well, point to is documentary evidence. The inability of women to provide evidence of their marriages to soldiers. So let me back up a bit. And that is to say that all widows, no matter their color, under the pension laws, one in 1864 opens up to address the fact that, well, the general law pension system is set up early in the war. Black soldiers who have families are unable to successfully make claims because they have to establish marriage under these laws. Enslaved people, we know their marital relationships are not sanctioned by law, but we know that they exist. And so in 1864, lawmakers say, well, we will accept eyewitness testimony to account for that legal documentation. But one of the points that I try to make throughout the book is to really make the point that no matter what system Black women are claiming under, they are always facing this obstacle of marriage. Now, some may say, and some have said, well, the Pension Bureau went quite far to accept eyewitness testimony. But the other point, and why I started saying, you know, I really wanted to explore how Black women were engaging the Pension Bureau, and more importantly, the ideas that they were presenting to the Pension Bureau. They're presenting as legitimate their family structures, their marital structures, that oftentimes fall outside of pension officials' understanding of the sort of heterosexual nuclear norm. And as a result of that, alongside ideas about Black women's sexuality or immorality, they oftentimes are facing this obstacle. And so that's one of the major interventions that I try to make in this study. I then join what other scholars have presented, which is that in addition to not being able to present evidence of legal marriage with documentation, they don't have birth certificates. They have a hard time securing medical evidence from doctors to establish their husband's service-related injuries. They have a long time, sometimes hard time, sometimes establishing what regiment their husband was in. There's also oftentimes they have issues with naming. Sometimes men present themselves to recruiting officials and they change their name at the point of enlistment, in part because they want to remain underground. And so there's a number of different complications, to include many of the Black women who traveled with regiments who were employed as nurses as such. And James Schultz has done just a terrific job of you know, raising this question and issue to our attention. But oftentimes they're laboring along with the regiments, and they are, you know, nurses, for example, are ineligible for pensions until 1892. So there's a number of things, both in terms of documentation, but also because of sort of ideas about Black women's immorality that prevent them from laying claim to what I call a union widowhood, and really obscuring how people's ability to see these women as you know, part of the union cause. And I think that the Bowie Blunt makes this point so brilliantly in her more recent book, The Women's Fight, that we don't tend to see Black women as union widows and as war widows. Yeah.
And so some of the actors in this study are claims agents that are both Black and white. And so I wonder if you could talk about the role that they play in your study.
Well, they're quite significant. In New Bern, you have the first sort of wave of pension claims agents. Claims agents are, for all practical purposes, acting as attorneys. They are sometimes licensed attorneys in the state. And so by that, I mean they're licensed by the state of North Carolina to practice law. But there are others who are essentially representing claims within the Pension Bureau and within the Pension Bureau referred to as attorneys, but don't have licensure to practice law within the state of North Carolina. So this was really a fascinating, you know, sort of story that I was able to tell from staying deeply immersed in the records and telling the local story, because I began to see that there was, you know, this full sort of industry of claims agents or attorneys, if you will, who were deeply involved in this process. And in some respects, I think, you know, when I was giving early conference papers, people really wanted to know more about the claim agents than the women's claims themselves. And that is because these people were fascinating. One of those persons to emerge, in New Bern at least, is a man by the name of Frederick Douglass. And I always have to stop and say, not the abolitionist leader. But from what I can tell, a former slave who emerges from Eastern North Carolina in Jones County, in fact, his first client was his mother. And over time, he works with white claims agents. Those agents were oftentimes agents of the Freedmen's Bureau. Sometimes they're just ambitious individuals who have come to North Carolina during the war and are trying to make a go of things. Sometimes they're local individuals who lived in New Bern or returning individuals who came to New Bern. Augusta Seymour would go on to have a brilliant career on the United, you know, in North Carolina's courts. So it's really interesting to look at this question from the perspective of both Black and white claims agents. White agents oftentimes were able to use their work as claims agents on behalf of Blacks and whites as a stepping stone to advance their careers within the legal system, even if they had made missteps. And even in the case of a man by the name of E.W. Carpenter, who had his license suspended, right? He was accused in part because of complaints filed by Black widows saying that he wasn't turning over their monies. Douglass' story is far more complicated. And what I've come to understand is while Douglass really becomes a centerpiece in Eastern North Carolina, and I would definitely say, you know, Douglass owes his career to these women. I think that, you know, that he would and injured veterans. But they also trusted him. Douglass was, again, former slave who emerges from this refugee community. And sometime by 1870, I believe he's taking on the name Frederick Douglass. But he would go on to represent both widows, Black and white, and Black and white soldiers seeking disability benefits from the Pension Bureau until his license was suspended. And it's about 1894, but if you're reading the pension records, it starts to get fuzzy because he really sort of goes after trying to get his license reestablished. But I say that to say because, you know, Douglass isn't able to reestablish himself as a pension attorney in the Bureau, nor did he have the kind of illustrious career that other white agents did at the time. Douglass, you know, I try to tell his story with warts and all in the study. There are questions. He is heavily surveilled by pension examiners who come into the area who are interviewing widows during the process of the claims, you know, process, but also paying close attention to Douglass. And quite frankly, I think that's because Douglass was so successful at helping so many people gain benefits. He's not completely successful. There are several members of his, you know, or clients that he has that aren't able to secure benefits from the Bureau, but he's quite successful, and that sort of captures the imagination of you know, Bureau officials in Washington, D.C. They want to know what's going on. Sometimes they say he's making up evidence about medical injuries. Sometimes they accuse him of attributing women being married to soldiers, you know, more than one soldier. So just a lot of different charges that he faces and ultimately has his license suspended. But part of the point that I try to make in the book and other articles that I've written is that no matter Douglass's intentions, he still facilitates a process in women's ability to sustain a long-term relationship with the federal government. And I think that these women who make up his client base understand, and men as well, understand who Douglass is. they understand who he is in his community, and they feel comfortable with him representing his claims. And so even after he is suspended, I have what I think is good evidence that he is continuing to support this community, even by doing writing or other, you know, alerting them, you know, individuals to their rights within the bureaus or different avenues or approaches that they can take if their claim has been rejected. So it's a long answer to say that I think claim agents play a really important role in terms of communicating about rights and what people are eligible for within the pension system, but also helping them facilitate that relationship over long spans of time. So in some ways, I'm answering the question that I set up in the beginning. You know, how are women able to do this? Well, they're able to do it because of their own tenacity, learning about pension laws, but also the relationships that they're building with Black middle-class professionals during the time. And that's certainly the case in New Bern.
And so one of the things I was sort of taken with was the special examiners. So I wonder if you could talk about sort of the tensions that existed between the Black Union widows and special examiners. And if you could just sort of give us a bit of an idea of what this special examination process was.
Yeah, so this is really the heart of the study, and I think also gets back to initially when we started talking about the book, what it does, and when I made the decision to say, you know, I wanted to understand how Black women were engaging the pension bureau. To ask that question in a place like New Bern is to talk about the special examination process and system. Special examination proceedings look much like, or, you know, court trials. They are not court trials, but examiners, that is representatives of the pension bureau, are coming in to communities across the South. So certainly not just New Bern, but communities across the South to follow up on women's cases. What I saw very early on when I was collecting materials for this study and really not having a clue of what I was doing, but many of the case files that I was pulling were just huge. I mean, there were numerous investigations. It wasn't just one special examination, but a woman might have 3 to 4 special examinations over the course of her case. And I, you know, after a while, I said, well, wait a minute, what is going on here? Part of that is because, as I said earlier, women aren't able to provide certain kinds of legal documentation of their marriages, families, children's birth. And so examiners are coming down to actually capture that eyewitness testimony and evidence of marriage. That's also happening because there's a sense that, sometimes women are not living their lives, or there's a sense that are these actually worthy widows? Are they worthy of, you know, this name, Union Widows? And so that's part of sort of what's going on in the title of my book, Claiming Union Widowhood. What did it mean for poor Black women to be claiming benefits and collecting benefits on the same terms that white Union widows of the North were, but also who was making decisions about that? The nature of the special examination process was that not only would special examiners come in and interview the petitioner, but they would also interview their immediate family members, neighbors, sometimes ministers, just oftentimes former enslavers, usually their employer. They would really try to get a sense of their life and how they were living their lives and what terms they were living their lives on. And that, for me, you know, so when you talk about sort of Black women's engagement with the federal government, legal institutions, for Black women, that was really their interaction with special examiners. Special examiners came to represent the U.S. pension bureaucracy. And over time, what I noticed in the pension records is that the more that women interacted with special examiners, the better they understood pension law. So now they're interacting with claims agents, they're interacting with special examiners, and they begin to talk in the language of the state to present their cases, oftentimes in very savvy ways. But what I oftentimes saw in the records was this idea that Black women were sexually immoral, and therefore underserving of these benefits. And so one of the points that I also try to make in the book is that even when we see successful rates, that is, women who are successful at claiming benefits from the Bureau, we have to say, well, wait a minute, how long did that last? Because oftentimes, I mean, I have examples of women who gained benefits, you know, after a long-term struggle of maybe 3 years it might take them to get on the pension roster, and then a year later they're off the roster. And the rest of what you're seeing in the pension file is really them trying to reestablish their name on the pension roster by talking about their worthiness within their community. So it's a very complicated story of really me trying to say, wait a minute, these women are presenting their own notions of worthiness and respectability, and not necessarily ideas of the Black middle class, right? And so oftentimes you'll see even tensions within the Black community, and that's really what I was interested in. What's happening within the Black communities over the meaning of union widowhood? Why, in some cases, community members are coming out to support some women, that same woman years later, people will offer a very negative testimony that results in them having their name drawn off of the pension rosters. All of that is bound up in the special examination process, because the special examiners are capturing that information on the ground within the communities during that period. So it's the pension records are very uneven. They are, I don't want to give the idea that they are easy to work with. They are not. They can sometimes be even very difficult to locate, which helps us understand how difficult it was to establish a claim within the pension system. But they can also be a wonderful way to get into the world of Black folk in the late 19th century and really sort of walk around in their world and see their world from their perspective, which was you know, quite illuminating for me. And you know, many questions that I present in the book, I'm still sort of sorting through. Yeah.
Perfect. And so I wonder what you want readers to take away from reading your book.
Well, I think several things I want them to take away from the book. But the first thing that I would want to say is that, you know, never underestimate the tenacity and skill sets of poor people, that even though this is a study that presents like many of these are individual claims, this is absolutely a movement of community relationships and women, poor women, really showing their clear understanding of the law and their ability to move within the law and governmental institutions, and then use those resources within their communities. And so it's very much a community study about, as well, the complicated nature of class as it emerges within late 19th century African-American history. I think I would also want people to walk away saying, wow, you know, there's so much to be uncovered and discovered in the stories of Black life in the American South. And I think that my book only begins to scratch the surface of that. I still find myself returning to the very people that I wrote about because they taught me so much about the American South and the possibilities that they envisioned for themselves, for their children, for their communities in the post-war South. And that gives me a tremendous amount of hope. And it also gives me you know, sort of reflection points in difficult political times as these women are experiencing not only lives of enslavement, transitioning during the Civil War, moving through a period of Reconstruction, and then moving to a more segregated society, that they remained hopeful and they continue to press the federal government and locate openings to express and claim rights for themselves. And I think that continues to inspire me, and I hope that people will walk away with that, and it will raise questions and intrigue for them, and they'll join me in the archive.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Brandi Bremer, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I'll just ask one final question. What are you working on now?
Well, this is a summer month, so I am working on starting my garden. my little pot garden in front of my house. But I'm also working on, I'm not going to call it a biography, but a thematic study of claim agents, with the centerpiece being Frederick Douglass, who I talked a lot about this afternoon. It will be more of a history that really sort of tries to dig into some of the major sort of core themes of African-American history, from naming, of course, I mean, how could I not, with his name, Frederick Douglass. it will certainly play a bit with that, but also thinking about socio-legal processes and really sort of making the case to think about more expansive sort of politics in late 19th century Black communities. So I'm really going to use that as an opening point. Continue to work through Freedmen's Bureau records, Southern Claims Commission records, but also pension records to deepen understandings about Black community, political communities and legal communities during the post-emancipation South. So,
wow,
that's
wonderful.
That's what I'm working at. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. So obviously you're going to be working with the pension records there. Do you have any tips for anybody else that's going to be working with pension records?
Well, you know, I would say be patient. I would say be, what's the word I'm looking for? Just really diligent. You know, there's many cases that I have. You know, I was looking at old records that I have, but many times, you know, I had to write different federal agencies over long periods of time. I spent an enormous amount of time at the National Archives. You know, a lot of that has changed, and it's changed because of COVID-19, how we interact with archives. Much of that was changing even before COVID. You know, when I started this project many, many years ago, I was able to photocopy batches of files, you know, at one time. That's all changed, you know. But what else has changed is that there are really important digital tools that can at least make the process, if you do that work on the front end, identifying names, filling out the sort of paperwork, it can make the experience go faster once you're at the National Archives. And I think the difference that my study made is that I did look at people in a concentrated area, and so I was able to make connections between cases that would have looked very differently if I took, you know, case files from different locations. And I think there's something to be said for that, right? Because it was helpful for me to build on the work of other scholars. But folks like Norley Franco and myself, Leslie Schwalm, one could argue, more recently, Holly Pinheiro, really looking at cases in a concentrated area, I think tells really important community histories that my hope is that over time, those will link up. And that for me started with the pension record. So I would say be patient. It is frustrating. It can be very difficult. But I think the thing that has sustained me is just knowing that the women themselves went through this process. And so I'm gonna go through the process as well, try to piece together the stories.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Wonderful. So Dr. Brandi Clay Brimmer, author of Claiming Union Widowhood, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Likewise. Thank you so much.